see if I have it.
What?
This time is speaking.
You have everything on your desk.
Okay.
Se declara abierto.
The 11th meeting of the 9th session of the Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues is called to order. Distinguished members of the forum, this morning, in accordance with its program of work, the Permanent Forum will continue its consideration of item 7 of the agenda. It is entitled Future Work of the Permanent Forum, including issues of the Economic and Social Council and emerging issues, presentation and discussion of the following reports. Report on Indigenous peoples and boarding schools, preliminary study on the impact on Indigenous peoples of the international legal construct known as the Doctrine of Discovery. This has served as the foundation of the violation of their human rights. Consideration of issues relating to Beijing plus 10. We will give the floor to Ms. Friedschnitt. She will be offering the preliminary study on the impact of Indigenous peoples of the international legal construct known as Doctrine of Discovery. This has been served as the foundation of the violation of their human rights.
Señora Gonella.
Miss Gonella Friedschner, you have the floor.
Carlos, la señora ha pedido que al primero llama
a... Sí, yo lo voy a llamar, pues, pero que hable. ¿Todo?
¿Están
bien? No sabía, no me...
¿A quién le tiene que dar la palabra?
Try this again, Mr. Chairman. Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for calling me on this particular agenda item. I'd like to give warm greetings to all my distinguished colleagues and all the distinguished representatives in the room and greet them in the Onondaga language of Nyawehaskanu. I am pleased to announce, Mr. Chairman, the completion of the preliminary study of the Doctrine of Discovery, which was requested by the 8th session of the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. The preliminary study is now translated and available under the title Impact on Indigenous Peoples of the International Legal Construct Known as the Doctrine of Discovery, which has served as the violation of their human rights. The preliminary study of the Doctrine of Discovery is mentioned in the Indigenous Peoples Global Caucus Statement and the Indigenous Women's Caucus Statement and in the report of the North American Caucus Preparatory Meeting held in the territory of the Alexis Nakota Sioux Nation in Canada. It is also mentioned in the intervention of the Indigenous Youth Caucus. Mr. Chairman, there is now a great deal of support for the convening of an expert group meeting on the doctrine of discovery and for a comprehensive study of the doctrine to be conducted by a representative from each of the seven regions identified by the permanent form. Mr. Chairman, the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is a significant step in the direction of honoring and upholding Indigenous peoples' human rights, individual and collective, including the right to and of self-determination. The Declaration is the product of Indigenous peoples working towards solving a problem they all share. However, the problem is not to be found in the actual text of the Declaration, and this is the importance of the preliminary study. Mr. Chairman, the preliminary study identifies this shared problem as the legal construct known as the doctrine of discovery, an interpretive framework that has resulted and continues to result in violations of Indigenous peoples' human rights throughout the world. That interpretive framework is the root problem facing Indigenous peoples. As identified in the preliminary study, it has two main elements. First, Mr. Chairman, dehumanization, and second, dominance. The first thing Indigenous peoples share is the experience of having been invaded by those who treated us without compassion because they considered us to be less than human or not even human. Dehumanization leads to the second thing we as Indigenous peoples share in common, being treated on the basis of the belief that those who invaded our territories have a right of lordship or dominance over our existence, and therefore have the right to take, grant, and dispose of our lands, territories, and resources without our permission or consent. This is the reason why a discussion of the human right of free, prior, and informed consent is critically important with regard to Indigenous nations and peoples. Mr. Chairman, the preliminary study is a first step toward resolving the root problem the Declaration is intended to address. Indigenous peoples are woven into the biological fabric of their traditional territories, which they are charged with a sacred responsibility to maintain for future generations. What is now referred to as a biological diversity is a direct result of Indigenous nations and peoples upholding that sacred responsibility for thousands of years. Now, others think they have the right to take, commodify, and even destroy these biosystems. And their dehumanization and domination based on the doctrine of discovery are steps toward that end. Once the Indigenous protection based on ecological knowledge and wisdom is removed, Mr. Chairman, the biological and ecological integrity of the traditional territory of a particular Indigenous nation is open to attack from the forces of mining and other forms of biosphere exploitation and destruction. The removal of Indigenous peoples' protection leads to destruction of the waters, trees, animals, and all other life forms, intricately interwoven and networked with the lives of the Indigenous peoples. Mr. Chairman, this is what Indigenous peoples have been experiencing, describing, and fighting for more than five centuries. We already see signs of ecological collapse in the overconsumption of fisheries, massive deforestation, toxic chemicals spewed across the earth and into waterways, which are the veins of Mother Earth. Indigenous peoples and the ecosystems they protect are indicators of the health of the earth, and the prognosis today is a state of crisis. Mr. Chairman, the preliminary study of the doctrine of discovery focuses on a very specific argument that can be traced back more than 500 years to the days of Western Christendom. It is an argument stated in a number of papal documents authorizing discovery and conquest and discovery and commerce. The argument may be expressed as follows. A Christian monarch who locates or discovers non-Christian lands and territories has the right to claim a superior and paramount title to these lands, territories, and resources. The doctrine of discovery states that non-Christian lands are considered to belong to no one because no Christians are living there and no Christian monarch or lord has yet claimed dominion. Once the claim of a right to dominion, sovereignty, and lordship was claimed by a Christian monarch, that claim was transferred to other political successors. Mr. Chairman, Francisco de Victoria was one theologian who did not agree with the view that Christian discovery could give dominion over and title to non-Christian lands. He argued that Indians had the true dominion from both a public and private law standpoint. Other thinkers arrived at the same conclusion. The issue was debated at length in the early 1550s in Spain by Sepúlveda and Bartolomé de las Casas, but no conclusive debate was arrived at. No indigenous peoples' representatives participated in the debate. It was a debate among Christian Europeans about indigenous peoples, and the issue was whether the Indians or indigenous peoples of the Americas were human. It was not a debate with indigenous peoples. Today, clearly, indigenous peoples have joined the debate by declaring most definitely that we are human beings. However, for more than five centuries, the doctrines of discovery and dehumanization have been institutionalized. And this is the context of the work we are doing on the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Mr. Chairman, the preliminary study focuses on the United States and points out that the doctrine of discovery was officially adopted by the United States government in an 1823 United States Supreme Court ruling known as Johnson versus McIntosh. The Johnson decision expressed and used in its deliberations the argument mentioned above, dating back to the days of Western Christendom. The U.S. Supreme Court referred to that doctrine as the principle, and I quote, that discovery gave title to the government by whose subjects or by whose authority it, the discovery, was made against all other European governments. Unquote. The court explicitly referred to discovery by Christian people, notwithstanding the occupancy of the natives who were heathens. Mr. Chairman, the United States Supreme Court Chief Justice John Marshall identified the Royal Charters of Great Britain pertaining to North America as the documentary source of the argument that discovery gave title to the government by whose authority the so-called discovery was made. The Royal Charter issued to John Cabot in March 1496 was issued in imitation of earlier papal bulls. It authorized Cabot and his sons to seek out isles, countries, and regions of the heathen and infidel, which before this time have been unknown to all Christian people. This and similar language were cited as the basis for the ruling in Johnson versus McIntosh, that the United States had the ultimate dominion over Indian peoples and lands. The Johnson ruling also cited recognition of the doctrine of discovery and assertion of dominion by Spain, Portugal, France, and Holland. The ruling also mentioned the East India Company in relation to the doctrine of discovery. It should be noted that the doctrine of discovery also relates to the history of Russia. This shows the global scope of the application of the doctrine and its concomitant framework of dominance. Mr. Chairman, it is on the basis of this line of thinking that Indian land rights have been characterized in U.S. law and policy as nothing more than a permissive right of occupancy, or permission from the whites for the Indians to occupy their own lands. This was expressed by the U.S. Supreme Court in the 1955 ruling Teton Indians versus the United States, and the doctrine of discovery was referenced as recently as 2005 in the decision the City of Sherrill versus the Oneida Indian Nation of New York. A strong case can be made for the view that the critical problems and human rights violations faced by indigenous peoples are all traced to the doctrine of discovery. The State of the World's Indigenous Peoples, for example, report pinpoints key indicators of the critical conditions faced by indigenous peoples. Each and every one of the caucus statements and indigenous peoples' interventions made at the ninth session of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues provides clear documentation of the impacts of the doctrines of discovery and dominance on indigenous nations and peoples in every part of the world. Mr. Chairman, for all the above reasons, an expert group meeting on and comprehensive study of the doctrine of discovery is very much needed to investigate the global scope of the application of that doctrine as a source of the violation of the human rights of indigenous nations and peoples. A comprehensive study of the doctrine will provide the opportunity to understand that all the various struggles that indigenous peoples are engaged in are a manifestation of the same root cause, which is the claim by one people of a right of dominance over another. Mr. Chairman, Daneto, I am finished.
Ms. Gonea Frichner, thank you for sharing with us the early version of your study. I would like to mention the following. You had discussed the legal 1830s and 1840s in the United States. In the 1840s in my country, in Bolivia, the government also declared that the indigenous peoples possessed states' lands, the state's land, because the state was generously endowing them with those lands. And that was the beginning of the attack on Indian lands that came in the years following. This is a doctrine that has deprived all indigenous peoples of our lands, of our territories, and of our resources. I think that it is important to recall that this doctrine is a doctrine that comes from a time when the colonizers didn't even know our countries. The powerful religious leaders thought at the time that there is just one power and one religion, and that it was that power would give lands unknown to the adventurers, possession of those lands, and the power to issue laws that go against our peoples. It is important to remember these discussions of the religious leaders in the 1600s, Sepulveda, among others. It is very important for all of the indigenous peoples to have your final version of that study when you have it. So thank you very much, Ms. Gonea Frichner. Yesterday, the permanent forum held a debate on some of the reports and studies included in item 7 of the agenda, A stroke C-119, stroke 2010, stroke L-1. In this meeting, the speakers will address the aspects that were covered in agenda item 7. I would like to welcome Meedy Wilson, Commissioner Meedy Wilson, and invite Judge Sinclair and Mr. Child and Commissioner Wilson to join me here at the podium. First off, the permanent forum will hear from Judge Murai Sinclair from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. I give the floor to Mr. Murai Sinclair.
Oh, there. Is it ready?
Yep.
It's ready. Am I on now? It's my turn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Your Excellencies, expert members of the Permanent Forum, distinguished elders, ladies and gentlemen, our delegation wishes to begin by thanking and honoring the Haudenosaunee, the traditional caretakers of these territories. I'm Justice Murray Sinclair, chairperson of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada. And I'm here with my fellow commissioners, Marie Wilson and Chief Wilton Littlechild, representing Canada's Truth Commission. Nous sommes reconnaissants d'avoir l'occasion.
We welcome and are appreciative of the opportunity to be with you today for this important gathering.
Today about Canada's experience with boarding schools, or residential schools as we call them. We are here to talk about shaping who we are as individuals, as communities, as cultures, and as nations. We are also going to talk about the role that the international community can play in the outcome of those issues. Truth commissions have functioned with varying degrees of success around the world for many years. Those commissions have come about primarily because an act or policy of a government caused significant harm to its people, and such harm had to be acknowledged and addressed. Canada has experienced such harm for more than 150 years. During that time, Canada enforced a racist policy of assimilation against Indigenous peoples through the use of boarding schools. The belief was that Indigenous peoples were inferior and uncivilized, and with the assistance of church organizations, they could be Christianized and therefore become civilized and equal. The Canadian government stated early on that through their policy of assimilation, within a century, Indian people would cease to exist. The government targeted children, the most vulnerable. Schools became the government's vehicle to enforce this process. The thinking of the day was to kill the Indian in the child so that within a few generations, Indigenous cultures, beliefs, languages, and distinct identities would be extinguished. For roughly seven generations, nearly every Indigenous child in Canada was sent to a residential school. They were taken from their families, tribes, and communities, and forced to live in those institutions of assimilation. The results, while unintended, have been devastating. We witness it first in the loss of Indigenous languages and traditional beliefs. We see it more tragically in the loss of parenting skills, and ironically, in unacceptably poor education results. We see the despair that results in runaway rates of suicide, family violence, substance abuse, high rates of incarceration, street gang influence, child welfare apprehensions, homelessness, poverty, and family breakdowns. Yet, while the government achieved such unintended devastation, it failed in its intended result. Indigenous people in Canada never assimilated. Avant même la fermeture,
even before the closing of the last Indian boarding house around the middle of the 1990s, one very important result had become clear. The policy had failed. Indigenous cultures, traditions, and languages have survived. They have been damaged, in many cases, badly so. But they are still beautiful and very much alive.
Indigenous parents and communities had resisted, as best they could, this policy of assimilation and the laws that enforced it. To overcome that resistance, Canada had passed laws that denied Indigenous people the right to vote, so they could not influence lawmakers and the laws they made. It created a pass system to control their movement. It declared their traditional ceremonies illegal. It prohibited them from gathering in groups so they could not organize protests. And it made it illegal for them or others to raise money to hire lawyers to take legal action. Prior to the schools, Indigenous communities and parents had welcomed Europeans to Canada and had shared the natural gifts of the country with them. They accepted that Europeans had much to offer, such as education in the ways of the world and literacy. They wanted their children to have those skills and that knowledge. In Western Canada, treaties were signed, and in those treaties, schools were to be provided. But the government implementation of the schools clause came with a terrible price. Children were taken forcibly and placed into schools far away from the reserves where the government had promised they would be. In many cases, Indigenous students were subjected to terrible abuse. Hundreds, if not thousands, died in the schools. Parents were not told the full extent of what was happening to their children. Visiting children at the schools was discouraged and in many places not permitted. Loneliness and fear were the Indigenous students' constant companions. In light of its growing failure, and with the dawning of an awareness of what human rights should look like after the Second World War, Canada gradually restored basic human rights to Indigenous people. The pass system, prohibitions on ceremonies, the denial of access to the courts, and the denial of the right to vote all fell away. Beginning in the 1970s, the residential schools era slowly ended, with the last residential school closing in 1996. But a great wrong had been done, and the damaged and injured survivors of those schools sought redress through an increasingly enlightened Canadian court system. Canada and the churches were sued. Individuals were prosecuted for their crimes, and in some cases finally held to account. But it was soon obvious that a court solution would take too long, be too expensive, and would impose more harm on former students, many of whom were quite elderly. In 2007, the survivors, the government, and the churches negotiated a court-approved settlement rather than continue fighting through litigation. The Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada was a condition of that settlement. The settlement agreement created it. It exists because the survivors wanted it. They agreed to set aside $60 million of their compensation fund for the Commission's purposes. The Commission functions with survivor money. Unlike others, it is not a government-imposed solution. It is to the courts and the parties of that agreement that the TRC is accountable. The TRC is not here to lay blame or to determine guilt. We cannot compel testimony or grant immunity. We do not decide compensation. There are others who do that. We are here to determine our future as a nation. Our first obligation is to show the true and complete story of residential schools. The history of residential schools is likely the least known dimension of Canadian history. It is not taught in our schools. It is not commemorated anywhere in our country or in our national capital. The 150-year history of residential schools has not been made a part of our national memory. It has been ignored, or worse, dismissed. What is known, however, to most Canadians is the present legacy, that Indigenous peoples in Canada do not have the same standard of life that is enjoyed by mainstream Canada. They easily fall into the trap of blaming Indigenous people for the conditions in which they live and for failing to address their problems adequately. That blaming leads inevitably to disrespect. That disrespect, however, also comes from the many generations of public policy founded on the view that white Euro-Canadians were superior, a view supported by law and taught in schools to Indigenous and non-Indigenous students alike. Mainstream Canada sees the dysfunction of Indigenous communities but have no idea how that happened, what caused it, or how government contributed to that reality through the residential school policy. They do not realize that just as Indigenous children were taught that they were inferior, so were non-Indigenous children. They do not realize that for the non-Indigenous child, this teaching had an insidious aspect. It reinforced a false belief in their own superiority. This, too, must be addressed. Most Canadians do not realize, therefore, that for there to be true reconciliation, they must be part of the solution. Education delivered through residential schools was the tool for assimilation. It was education that helped to perpetuate the situation we see today for Indigenous peoples in Canada. We at the TRC believe that it will be education again that will be the tool that best addresses all of that. For education will create knowledge, and from knowledge will come understanding. From understanding will come respect, both self-respect for Indigenous people and mutual respect for all. We are determined to tell all of Canada and the people of the world that history. We will do that through gathering and revealing the experiences of those who attended the schools, worked at the schools, or had any role in the operation of the schools. We, through the Commission, will gather statements from all of those individuals and their children who wish to tell us how that experience impacted them. And we will make that information available to everyone. That history is something that we all must teach our children and grandchildren. That history must be offered in classrooms across the country. We call for these things so that in a few generations, in place of disruption, dysfunction, and disrespect, we will see a Canada where the relationship between Indigenous Canadians and non-Indigenous Canadians is founded on mutual respect. But there is an aspect of respect that is fundamentally important. We at the Commission are aware of the degree to which the intergenerational survivors, the current children and grandchildren of survivors, hunger for more than just knowing why. We know that they also hunger for a proper sense of self. The need to assist current and future generations of Indigenous youth to find their place and purpose through cultural and language revitalization is quite apparent. Indigenous children are much more than the color of their skin. They are the products of their community, and they have the right to know what that community is. They have the right to know where they have come from, where they are going, why they are here, and who they are. The answers to such questions of life are not found in books. They are found in the experience of one's relationship with family and with friends, and in the teachings of the community to which you feel you belong. Non-Indigenous youth, by and large, have that. Indigenous youth do not. We see, therefore, that in order for there to be mutual respect for Indigenous youth, there must also be a process to help them achieve self-respect. It is an aspect of the reconciliation component of our mandate that we take very seriously. Our work is just beginning. In a few short weeks, we will meet at our first national event with residential school survivors and others who will provide statements to us. Many of these individuals will speak of their experiences for the first time. The rest of Canada will be invited to come and listen and speak of what they need to say as well. The international community has something to contribute to this process. We invite you all to participate with us and bear witness to our activities. We would like to propose that the United Nations Permanent Forum sponsor an international roundtable on truth commissions to be spearheaded by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada within the next 2 years. At that roundtable, we would propose to discuss how truth commissions should impact the lives of Indigenous peoples in the world. We would also propose to discuss how truth commissions have contributed to the advancement of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We close by observing that things are changing dramatically. We point to and acknowledge the government of New Zealand for its announcement last week that it will adopt the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We point to and acknowledge the statement by the representatives of the United States of that country's willingness to review its opposition to the declaration and to consult its Indigenous peoples as it does so. We point to and acknowledge that this year, the Government of Canada stated with respect to the declaration at the start of its current parliamentary session that it will take steps to endorse this aspirational document in a manner fully consistent with Canada's constitution and laws. Nous sommes ravis de cette déclaration.
We are delighted about this declaration of intention, and we anxiously await the day when it will be implemented.
It encourages the establishment of an international decade of reconciliation and calls upon the members of the United Nations Permanent Forum to support this initiative. A year to reconcile such things is not enough. 5 years is not enough. A decade is only a start. Finally, the Special Rapporteur on Indigenous Peoples can count on our cooperation for any work by our commission that the UN wishes to examine within Canada. Nous nous réjouissons.
My fellow commissioners and I look forward to continuing our discussion with you in the time to come.
Invited to remain in this room following the morning's presentations for our side event, where we will be discussing the work of our commission in greater detail. Thank you. Merci.
Muchas gracias, señor.
Thank you very much, Judge. Thank you to the Honorable Justice for sharing Canada's experience with the reconstruction of historical memory of a facet that our colleague Gonilla had shared with us. And I'm referring to the impact of colonialism and the effect that this has had on all Indigenous peoples. In Latin America in particular, we have been the victims of the Indigenous policies that were aimed at assimilation of the Indigenous peoples through educational systems. Schools were also a vehicle of assimilation, a way to get us to forget our identity and our rights. I believe that the Canadian example can be very much emulated by the other countries when it comes to ensuring that the originating people, the First Nations, can regain that which they risked losing with colonization. I thank you, Justice. We will now offer time for comments. Margaret, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Chairman. I want to appreciate the speech given by my colleague, Toniela Frischner, and the statement and history given by the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Canada. Mr. Chairman, sir, dehumanization as a principle of discovery did not only affect Indigenous brothers and sisters in the continent of America. It also drastically affected Indigenous peoples in Africa. Indigenous peoples' rights were seriously violated or drastically violated. This was a philosophy in the mind of the Western world, where they could come to communities and say, close your eyes, pray, while they were grabbing our land. It was an unfortunate kind of scenario. Traditional local courts are no longer recognized because of the introduction of the Western kind of culture of, you know, handling cases, and yet our elders played a great role. Our languages, our traditional education were destroyed, and yet this were a basis of installing skills, values, and norms and identity to our people. Today, the UN DRIP stipulates the right to education, practice our traditional ways of life, and we should use as a strong advocacy instrument. It is therefore important that states ensure the inclusion of the UN DRIP in their policies and programs, in their frameworks, in different states of the world. Thank you, Chairman.
Gracias.
Thank you, Ms. Lukawa. Mr. Hassan Ilde Kassan.
Mr.
Chairman, I would like to tell you how pleased I am to having listened to this report on the conditions of the indigenous peoples and the harmful damages that they suffered due to the theory of exploitation by European colonization and the impact this had through the integration and assimilation policies on these people. The children who were placed in these schools for indigenous peoples and which destroyed their cultures through education. Education should have been the means for assisting the cultural identity of the indigenous peoples as well as their native languages. But it is the opposite that took place. And I would like to congratulate you on the major achievements that you have arrived at. Now, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is proof of your success and of your struggle for the indigenous peoples. And this will have a very positive effect on everyone in the world. However, I would like to mention the school in Africa, in the north of Africa. Since for many decades, schools did not take into consideration the cultural identities of indigenous peoples. And consequently, even in situations where children lived in their families, the schools imposed this assimilation policy on them, which destroyed the initial identities of these children. I wanted to point out that in North Africa, there about 60 years ago and after the independence of the countries in the north of Africa, cultures were established that consecrated the Arabic and North African cultures. However, they realized that this also destroyed the cultural identities of the indigenous peoples in North Africa. And this happened through the slogan of Arabization in order to create an Arab nation in the Middle East and in the North of Africa. Now, for children who did not know other languages, such as Arabic or the French, I lived in my own family. I only spoke my language, Anata Nazir, and I studied in a school that was very close to my home. However, as soon as I started going to school, I felt as if my language had been cut away from me, that my tongue had been cut away from me. I did not speak the language in the school. I only spoke the language spoken in my home. And in school, I had to use this other language, and this created a great deal of problems for me. What's more, the assimilation and integration policies in schools scorned the values, the original values, and scorned the original languages and traditions of the indigenous people. Children often look to their teachers as examples. They look up to them. And when an indigenous language is spoken in the classroom, the children are made to feel guilty. Sometimes they are slapped in the face because they pronounced words which were not the words of the official languages in the schools. This is something I lived through myself, and this actually created my awareness of the issues. When I opened my office as a lawyer in Morocco, I wrote one slogan in my office in the Ata Nazir language, and I was sent to jail for a week due to this, only for this thing, and having used the Tamazir language. What the indigenous peoples have suffered through in the Americas and throughout the world, and the struggle of the peoples of North Africa, have resulted now in the rehabilitation, the return of the Atamazir language, and has resulted in the creation of the Reconciliation Commission in Morocco. This was done not only to settle the various problems linked to Atamazirt, but also to eliminate these different problems in a more general manner. The Tamazirt peoples who speak the Tamazirt language created these rehabilitation and reconciliation committees for the peoples who had been imprisoned from the Tamazirt communities. Amongst other things, we are trying to reintroduce the Tamazirt language in schools in Algeria and Morocco. Thank you very much. And I am extremely pleased to see that this struggle is underway and that we have reached very positive results. Thank you.
Gracias, señor.
Thank you. We will now give the floor to our colleague Bartolome Clavero Salvador. Mr. Clavero, you have the floor. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to reflect upon the legal aspects of the practices of education in boarding schools, and not just in boarding schools, but in other open schools. These practices are aimed at eradicating the culture and the language of the children and youth of the indigenous peoples. I was recalling a book recently that looked into the matter here in the United States. The Churchill book, it is called Kill the Indians, Save the Man, which is a famous organization. It was called The Genocidal Impact of the Boarding Schools on the American Indian, that is. This is not just a matter of words. It is not just merely a way to express things. The genocidal impact, these practices are also included in the conventions on genocide and the prevention thereof. It considers genocide to include the forced transfer of children from one group to another. We don't need to see any blood spilt for there to be genocide in this case. More than half a century ago, this was defined thus, and this included physical transfer of children. But we don't even need physical transfer of children. If a state imposes obligatory education that only takes into account the non-indigenous language and culture, there will be genocide. This constitutes the crime of genocide. I suggest that this be borne very much in mind and with seriousness. Canada, Australia, and others, they should recognize the errors of these practices. Many of these have had effects that can no longer be remedies. Forgiveness is being asked for, but there is no case being brought before the ICC seeking criminal responsibility of those who organized these practices that are still alive today. This genocide is equal in international law to the Nazi genocide. Although scopes might be different, everything aims at focusing on the issue of criminal responsibility in some cases. However, in these cases, we see the states recognizing what happened, but without a commensurate treatment of this in international criminal law. This is genocide. A genocide that the states denounce before different international criminal jurisdictions with regard to these atrocious practices imposed on children and youth of indigenous peoples. This is not merely a matter of criminal responsibility. This is a matter of addressing the victims. There is to be redress in these cases, even if those responsible are not alive. And this is something that we must address in states, even those states that recognize that these policies were failed and misguided. I merely wish to put forth this reflection on a more legally rigorous treatment of these matters internationally that would come with recognition of these genocidal practices against the indigenous communities and cultures and languages, and not just of the Americas. Thank you very much.
Gracias a usted,
thank you, Professor Clavero, for that call for a rigorous legal framework for this. Certainly for indigenous peoples, it is this genocide that has led to the international indigenous movements. There's the content of the Declaration of Barbados. There we see how indigenism, through these assimilation policies, was facing genocide in a widespread manner throughout Latin America. And this has been the foundation for efforts aimed at fighting for the rights of the indigenous peoples. We will give the floor to our colleague, Mr. Michael Dodson, now. Mr. Dodson, you have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and good morning. Firstly, I'd like to express my deep appreciation to our colleague, Tanya Gunella Frischner for her report this morning on the work she's doing with this doctrine of discovery, and also express my deep appreciation to Judge Sinclair and others from the Canadian Truth and Reconciliation Commission for your presentation. I could have almost thought that I was at home. I was involved, Mr. Chairman, during the 90s and with the what was then the Australian Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, and I was a commissioner with that commission, and we presented a report in 1998 called the Bringing Them Home Report, and it was a report about the policies and practices and laws that forcibly removed Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander kids, children from their families and communities, and had them adopted out into foster care, into institution, into church-run missions, and other placements. And this practice really didn't cease. The last laws didn't get removed from the statute books in our country until the mid-1980s. And it had a devastating effect. And to hear the judge talk about the impact of these residential schools on Canadian Aboriginal children. As I say, I know that experience. Of course, we haven't had a comprehensive response to the recommendations by the Australian Human Rights Commission in its report. We're very appreciative that the federal government, under the present Prime Minister, offered an apology to the Stolen Generations for what had happened to them. And the Stolen Generations accepted that gracefully and with a great deal of dignity. But the key finding of the Commission in our country was that these policies, these practices, and the laws that were passed to enforce them were tantamount to genocide. And we based our response primarily on the the responses one would expect in international law to gross violations of human rights. And part of that involved a recommendation there be reparations. That hasn't occurred in our country at the national level. The previous federal government, the present federal government, refuses to countenance even a discussion about compensation, let alone or reparations, let alone putting together a practical response to that. I think the two things are connected. The doctrine of discovery and the forcible removal of children is... perhaps it's a way that the discoverers want to deal with our dehumanisation by seeing this as some form of humanising us in their own image. But I'm very interested in your proposals to... all three proposals. What our colleague has suggested in relation to discovery. There is a publication coming out from some Indigenous scholars later this year in Australia on this question of discovery. The idea that we further discuss this issue and actually try and get our nations to confront this and deal with it. It's not going to bring down the state, but it might bring better public policy in Indigenous affairs if we both agree and have an understanding about the issue of discovery and its impact, like the forcible removal of children from Indigenous peoples around the world. The idea of a round table to discuss this I find attractive and certainly something I could endorse. And also, finally, an international decade of, I think you said reconciliation, but I would prefer to say truth and reconciliation. That's something that has some attraction to me. So, Kali, I'm done.
Gracias.
Thank you, Mr. Dodson. We will now give the floor to our colleague, Mr. Carlson Smith, who will be providing information on the decision made by ECOSOC regarding the work of the Permanent Forum last year. He will also report on the work in the Permanent Forum on the Declaration of the United Nations on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Mr. Carlson Smith, you have the floor.
Thank you, Chair. Well, I shall, as member of the forum, say some words of information about ECOSOC's discussion of the Permanent Forum's report on the session last year, 2009. My comments relates to the annex of the report on Article 42 of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. When the declaration was adopted by the UN General Assembly in 2007, the Permanent Forum was assigned a new function based on Article 42, including the task to follow up the effectiveness of the declaration. The forum considered it to be a duty to discuss the new obligations of the forum and how the forum can fulfill those obligations. The forum started such a discussion in the 08 session, and ECOSOC decided to authorize an international expert group meeting on the implementation of Article 42. The meeting took place in January of 09. Following the pre-session meeting last year, a draft to a general comment to this article was presented to the forum, and in the report from the session in May of 09, paragraph 87 says, I quote, "The Permanent Forum adopts general comment number 1, 2009, entitled Article 42 of the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples," unquote. In July 2009, ECOSOC discussed the forum report. Some member states made specific comments to this annex of the report. The comments had the same message, that the Permanent Forum is not a monitoring body. In its pre-session meeting March this year, the forum agreed that it is important to respond to these comments. The forum decided that four forum members would prepare a paper for this purpose. A recommendation to this effect will be included in the report of the present session of the Permanent Forum. The debate on Article 42, which is a central legal rule for the work of the forum, will probably continue and should continue. It may be essential for the future work of the forum. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Smith. We will now open up our list of speakers. The first on our speakers list is Mr. Jean-François Tremblay, the Vice Minister of Policy and Strategic Affairs of Indigenous Affairs and for Northern Canada. Mr. Jean-François, you have the floor.
Mr. Chairman and distinguished colleagues, good morning and thank you for this opportunity to speak. Before I begin, I would like to thank the commissioners of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions for their presence this morning, and also for their inspiring presentation, and also for raising the awareness of the comprehensive history of residential schools in Canada, across the country, and now across the world. Thank you for that. Today, I would like to provide an update of the progress made by the Government of Canada in some of the areas covered under Agenda Item 7. First, I would like to come back on this issue of the residential schools, and I would like to address the progress made with respect to the implementation of the settlement agreement that was reached to address grievances and the class action relating to Indian residential schools operated by the Government of Canada.
Reconciliation and renewing the partnerships with Indigenous peoples constitute the fundamental pillars of Canada's action plan for Indigenous peoples. The convention with regard to the Indian boarding schools signals a historic change in the relations between the Indigenous peoples of Canada, the Church, and the Canadian government. The convention constitutes an excellent example of a very honorable approach focusing on collaboration, formulation of solutions to the harm done for such a long time. On the 11th of June 2008, the Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, presented on behalf of all Canadians his apologies to the former students of the Indigenous schools.
Indigenous leaders were present in the House of Commons and responded. The apology recognized the suffering of students and families from the residential school system and its continuing impact on Aboriginal cultures, heritage, and community. It was well received by Indigenous leaders and many survivors, and coupled with substantive elements of the settlement agreement, indicates the sincerity of all parties to develop a new relationship. Much progress has been made on the implementation of all aspects of the Indian Residential School Settlement Agreement. On date du 15 janvier 2010,
on the 15th of June 2010, the Canadian government received approximately 99,000 requests for shared experience payment, which focuses on acknowledging the common shared experience of the Indigenous students. About 75,000 former students would receive payment for a total of over $1.5 billion. What's more, the independent evaluation process was established for a individual payment for the suffering. On the 6th of December 2009, the Secretariat received close to 14,000 requests and held 4,500 individual hearings. Over 3,700 cases were resolved. Since September 2007, over $269 million Canadian dollars were paid out for damages. the hearings were held in local communities and in areas chosen by those presenting the requests.
The settlement agreement is the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada, the TRC, that was established in June 2008. The commission is mandated to raise awareness of the comprehensive history of residential schools and provide a report and recommendations to the parties of the agreement. Importantly, the commission, as part of its work, will ensure that the statements of former students, as well as anyone else affected by the Indian residential schools, are received and archived. The TRC will be hosting a first of seven national events on June 15, 2010, in Winnipeg, Manitoba. The national events are intended to engage and educate the Canadian public about the Indian residential school system. They will honor those whose lives were touched by residential schools and will also celebrate regional diversities. In concluding, or before concluding, I would like to also highlight some of Canada's recent efforts for healthier and stronger First Nations families and children. As you may know, le gouvernement du Canada.
The Government of Canada provides financing to service providers for the First Nations in the provinces and territories of the Yukon for providing prevention and cultural protection services, which are culturally adapted. This is in line with the laws of the provinces or territories. For several years now, the Government of Canada has also been working in the establishment of a new preventive approach for childhood protection on the reservations. This approach is focusing on reducing payment for children living on the reserves and keeping families together. There's a three-party agreement with the five provinces in Canada. This means that over half of the children of First Nations in Canada will be covered by this new approach. In the budget approved last March, the government approved additional financing in order to pursue this approach. Canada's aim is for all provinces and territories to adapt this new approach for prevention by 2013.
As distinguished colleagues, as was member of the commissions, thank you for this opportunity to provide you with this information that I hope demonstrate again Canada's continued commitment to working in partnership to build stronger Aboriginal families and communities. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, señor.
Thank you very much. It would be important for the permanent forum and the Indigenous peoples to have a summary or a study that covers this process of reconciliation. It will certainly serve as a good example of the situation and the efforts made for reconciliation in other countries. The next speaker on our list is Ms. Connie Taracena from the Permanent Mission of Guatemala. Madam, you have the floor.
Gracias, señor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, and good morning to one and all. I will be focusing on the policies and projects in climate change and the Indigenous peoples. Mr. Chairman, Guatemala is the heart of the Mayan world in peace with nature in the framework of the negotiation process for the convention and in the search for a new climate change system wishes to share its position. Its position is based on the efforts of countries to build a national platform that allows for us to reduce our vulnerability, improve our adaptation, and contribute to the reduction of greenhouse gases in step with the principles of common but differentiated responsibilities. This national strategy should be framed and supported by a binding universal agreement with a long-term focus. In this way, Guatemala is working to define and implement policies, programs, and projects on climate change that are aimed at activities in agriculture, health, food security, development infrastructure, and the prevention of disasters and risk management. The National Platform on Climate Change that is being built currently has the following components: a national policy on climate change, an interinstitutional commission on climate change, a framework law initiative on climate change, development projects focused on climate change. One of the primary activities has been that of putting together climate change policy to be implemented in Guatemala through an operational plan. This policy includes the matter of indigenous rights. It includes the indigenous institutions and the indigenous ombudsman's offices. They are part of the delegation, part of the technical committee. There's a focus on indigenous and rural women. They're the most vulnerable in climate change. The idea is to ensure that indigenous women be part of the decision-making processes in our country facing climate change. Given this, the Indigenous Ombudsman's Office established strategic alliances with the Guatemalan Foundation and the Indigenous Table on Climate Change. In the case of the first, the idea was to broaden the network for adaptation, and then there was an alliance aimed at incorporating the rights of indigenous peoples in the Framework Law Initiative on Climate Change. The objective of the policy is for institutions to incorporate into their plans, projects, and programs the matter of climate change under the political leadership of the Ministry of Environment and Natural Resources. We recommend that we ensure the participation of indigenous communities, in particular women, in the drafting of climate change policies and initiatives in order to reduce vulnerability, allowing for the best possible adaptation to climate change for the further development of the people of our country. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Our next speaker is Asure Peacock. She's from the Australia Youth Caucus. You have the floor. Is the speaker present with us in the room? You have the floor.
Por favor.
How do I just press this? Sorry, Mr. Chairperson. Forests are an integral part of the Indigenous life the world over. In Australia, forests are a rich source of our cultural economy, where Indigenous people still occupy land and utilise the abundant resources for food, medicine, spiritual, cultural, social and economic purposes. Within the Indigenous estate, large areas of forests and include important handback and joint management arrangements, native title determination, Indigenous protected areas and land council holdings. The affinity and connection to forests which Indigenous peoples hold is becoming increasingly recognised in international legal instruments, while the pressure on forests through deforestation and climate change increases. These opposing forces add impetus to the better recognition of Indigenous rights and forestries through international and national law and through corporate and other approaches. Much of the forested areas are still unsustainably logged and or stressed by lack of water through poor water management, urban sprawl or mining and other development. Furthermore, Indigenous people are increasingly participating in forest management or deliver environmental services without appropriate resources and the proper rights to forested land and the resources contained within. We recommend the following. 1. That the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states, including the Australian government, to fully implement the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and review existing legislative and administrative measures. 2, that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states to fully protect Indigenous knowledge and cultural heritage within the forests, including fully adapting the AQUICON guidelines. 3, that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states to ensure that the Indigenous peoples are able to fully participate in monitoring and reporting on all forested sites, including Ramsar sites and other sites that are internationally significant. 4, that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states to comply with the Articles 27 and 28 of the Declaration by ensuring that concrete measures are taken to immediately restore Indigenous peoples' rights to their land, territories and resources. 5, that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states to review unsustainable logging and mining and other extraction activities where Indigenous peoples' rights to lands, territories and resources exist, and ensure that the rights to free, prior and informed consent are exercised. 6, that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urge all states to ensure that the adequate supply of water to natural forests is maintained and able to sustain the ecosystem and cultural economy, including cultural flows. And lastly, that the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues urges all states to fully protect the cultural and intellectual property of traditional knowledge systems, including access and benefit sharing, particularly those that rely on knowledge of traditional medicine, food sources and other resources within the forest. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Gracias a usted.
Thank you. Our next speaker is Mr. Sergio Hinojoso from Coyasuo. Sir, you have the floor. He is from the National Council of Aluyus and Marcos from the Cayasuyo. Thank you, brother. Mr. Condori, a warm greeting from our association in Bolivia. We are part of the 5 organizations that are working together within the plurinational state of Bolivia. We wish to, at this time, let you know that in Cochabamba, in Bolivia, we had the World Forum on Climate Change and the Declaration of Mother Earth. We would like for there to be a respect shown for that which we've heard today. Originating people have existed for more than 500 years, and we have kept our cultural identity throughout this period of endurance. In Bolivia, we have endured the colonial state. We have maintained our cultural identity. Now, through fights, through protests, we are now in the seat of the plurinational state of Bolivia. There must be a decolonization. We have moved from colonialization that was imposed on us. The colonial state has imposed neoliberalism. The Western ideas have been imposed on us. And this has not worked in Bolivia. Now, more than ever, we wish to push forth with the decolonization. We wish to recover our ideologies, those of the indigenous peoples, the original people, and this will allow us to move forward. And on the Declaration of Mother Earth, we see a call for the permanent forum to assist in ensuring that this be respected. Brother Carlos Mamami, thank you for your conduct of these efforts.
Gracias a usted.
Thank you. We will now give the floor to Mr. Kaab Malik of Pakistan. Mr. Kaab Malik, you have the floor.
Yes, thank you. Thank you, sir. Okay. With the name of the Creator, the Merciful, the Beneficent, Honorable Chair and Delegate and Chiefs, and Indigenous brothers and sisters, I greet you with a greeting of peace. I salute the Indigenous pioneer who struggled day and night to bring the permanent farm into reality. For the last 15 years, I myself witnessed upon the journey. It was difficult to reach at this stage. My special thanks to Indian Law Alliance, the courageous Tania Ganala Freshner, for her leadership. As Chief Lyon said, we could not cross the street. We used to hold meeting in church building, not in the UN. The law of the Creator keeps balance. We have to rise. The indigenous peoples are one, the language the same, the living style the same, the problem the same. Our struggle to protect Mother Earth is the same. Under Article 332, I have submitted documents on the Kalash indigenous and co-people to our first president, Ole Henrik Mega. But just to update the climate change, the impact has caused glacier melt, we call it Shayos, and melted and swept away two villages, Sonor and Brep. Loss of human life, houses, land, orchards, cattle, and life and pastures destroyed. And mining the same problems, and in Hindu Kush, the people have only mountain. The government of NWFP leased out 700 square miles to mainland Carp in Pakistan without consulting locals. Corporation, the same problem. In the Kalash tradition, custom, and the women go to a special house for their monthly. It is called Bashaleni. No male is allowed in that area. PTDC, Pakistan Tourism Development Corporation, built hotel right in front of that house, violating the privacy of the Kalash women. We need peaceful solution to save indigenous people and the Mother Earth. Honorable Chair, and I have three recommendation. From elementary school to high education, we have curriculum courses in all fields of life. These courses are designed to be capital market oriented and focus solely on money making. With these tools, they use any means to make dollar. In result, we have gone too far to damage ourselves and Mother Earth. As an indigenous people, we have responsibility to teach a balanced life that may lead to a peace and harmony with ourselves and with Mother Earth. Mr. Chair, since the draft declaration was adopted, we shall have indigenous people flag outside the UN that represent the Mother Earth and indigenous people. This is number one. Number two, we shall introduce the compulsory course in education institution by the member countries that teach nations' exalted character so that man can understand the purpose of life on this earth. I request the permanent forum, if it's possible, all the indigenous people in their respective countries shall stand peacefully in front of their parliament with the banner of exalted character that invite them to have peace with Mother Earth. Then exalted characters as follows: peacefulness, mercifulness, justice, truthfulness, love, forgiveness, respect, patience, trust, harmony, balance, honesty, fairness, tolerance, sharing, right to life, right to security, right to indigenous resources, freedom, God-fearing, pure intention, appreciation, kindness, humbleness.
Señor, ruego a usted terminar su exposición.
Courageousness, wisdom, obedience, purity, prayer, clean heart, positivity, faithfulness, loyalty, piety, values, feeling of wrongdoing, consideration, compassionate, useful, productivity. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quiero recordarles que
I wish to recall to you that the matters before us today are those that have to do with the indigenous peoples and the boarding schools and the preliminary study on the impact of on indigenous peoples of the international legal construct known as Doctrine of Discovery, and also the issues relating to Beijing Plus 10. So I ask delegates to refer to these topics. We will now give the floor to Ms. Isabel Ortega, the Vice Minister of Justice of the Plurinational State of Bolivia. Madam Ortega, you have the floor. Thank you very much. We thank you, Mr. Chairman, and we thank all of those at the podium table. Right now, in these times of climate change, it is true that in Bolivia and with other countries, climate change is having a great impact. In the Department of Oruro in Bolivia, we have seen the effects of mines as well. We talk about climate change because the transnational companies, as we see in Oruro in Bolivia, are affecting things. We have two-headed cattle, five-legged cattle. These chemicals that they use are not ecologically sound. These mining companies are using these chemicals, and not just in the Department of Oruro, but all throughout Bolivia. We want for those involved in these companies to use environmentally sound practices. The private companies, the Interaime company, for example, we want them to not work with these chemicals. We want them to work in an environmentally sound manner. And we also wish to say that we see problems in the agricultural production. There are companies that have pesticides and chemicals that damage our agricultural products. We want this to be addressed on the global level and not just in our country. There should be environmentally sound practices that do not affect our organisms as they currently are. Thank you very much.
Gracias, señora viceministra.
Thank you, Madam Vice Minister. The next speaker on our list is Mr. Lars Madsen from the Permanent Mission of Denmark. Mr. Madsen, you have the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the Permanent Forum Indigenous Issues, distinguished representatives of indigenous peoples from around the world, excellencies, distinguished delegates. My delegation would like to express our gratitude to the presenters of today's report, and we've listened carefully to the wise and at times very disturbing words. With your indulgence, however, we would also like to just give a brief statement on some of yesterday's reports, a study to determine whether climate change policies and projects adhere to the standards of the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Recalling the appeal in the Anchorage Declaration that all RED initiatives must secure the recognition and implementation of IPR, including security of land tenure, amongst others, Denmark has taken a firm stand in connection with the support to the UN RED. RED Plus emerged as one of the points of consensus at the COP15 meeting in Copenhagen in December 2009. And the Copenhagen Accord recognized the crucial role of RED Plus and paved the way for establishing an immediate response mechanism enabling the mobilization of financial resources from the developed countries. Six developed country governments also pledged $3.5 billion in quick start finance for Red Plus. The UNFCCC process has yet to finalize the overall architecture and safeguard frameworks. And Denmark will do its utmost to bring the concerns of indigenous peoples forward during the future UNFCCC talks in Mexico in December 2010. Denmark has made a contribution to the UN Red, particularly emphasizing the implication of free, prior, and informed consent, as well as the standards in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. We are also providing support to the Forest Carbon Partnership Facility to assist forest countries in building capacity for preparing for RED. And importantly, we are supporting the IUCN initiative seeking to involve indigenous peoples in the national governance structure of the RED in a number of pilot countries. Mr. Chairman, Denmark will continue to support the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and its and the rights and the principles therein that are relevant to threats to indigenous peoples posed by climate change, as referred also to in the report of the Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights on the relationship between climate change and human rights. Furthermore, Denmark supports the development of a dedicated grant mechanism for indigenous peoples and local communities under the Forest Investment Program. This dedicated mechanism will provide grants to indigenous peoples in countries or regional pilots to support the participation in the development of forest investment strategies, programs, and projects. Support will focus on, inter alia, securing and strengthening customary land tenure and resource rights and traditional forest management systems. On pilot projects proposed by indigenous peoples and on involvement of indigenous peoples in the monitoring and evaluation of forest activities. Mr. Chairman, through our bilateral programs, Denmark has worked actively with indigenous groups in Malaysia, Vietnam, Nepal, Bolivia and Nicaragua, as well as with the pastoralists in East Africa. And we have on several occasions raised our concerns on development affecting indigenous people's rights. Over the coming year, we aim at increasing our support to climate change adaptation and mitigation with a particular emphasis on vulnerable groups, including indigenous peoples. Thank you for your time.
Gracias a usted, señor.
Thank you, sir. Our next speaker will be Mr. Luis Toro of the Organization of the American States, the OAS. Mr. Toro will be speaking to us on the process regarding the American Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Mr. Toro, you have the floor.
Muchas gracias, señor presidente.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I wish to avail myself of this opportunity to briefly sketch out the OAS's work on the protection and dissemination of the rights of indigenous peoples of the Americas. The OAS is a regional organization, part of the UN system. We were present in the year 2006 as well. I would like to look at four areas. The General Assembly mandates. Currently, the OAS is negotiating a draft American Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. A working group was created in the Commission on Political Affairs, was created for this. There are negotiation sessions with representatives of these states and representatives of the indigenous peoples. The most recent round of negotiation seeking consensus was held in November, between the 30th of November and the 2nd of December in Washington, D.C. In 2009, there was an indigenous caucus there as well. They had met previously in November. There have been 11 rounds of negotiations. We have a current reference document. It shows the current state of affairs. There are six sections and 41 items. Nine have consensus. 10 have been adopted. There's also a preamble. This has not yet been revised. I should mention also that the adoption by the UN has of the declaration has brought us to look at the impact of the look again at our project in the OAS. The General Assembly of the OAS in Lima will meet and will adopt a new resolution in order to give continuity to the working group looking to bring the adoption of the American Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. New negotiation rounds will continue to look at the outstanding matters of our current registry. I wish to seize this opportunity to thank Mexico, Nicaragua, and Spain and their governments. They have provided funds to this specific fund, which has allowed for the participation of at least one indigenous representative of each country at the meeting and from indigenous peoples. There are four areas that are being covered by seminars in Washington, D.C. to look at the participation of indigenous peoples in OAS activities, the idea being to enrich the work and to better integrate the indigenous views. The meeting will be held on 23 to the 26th of June. All matters working in this area will be present. We will have presentations from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights, the summit's secretariat of the OAS, and the Department of International Affairs and the Department of International Law that I represent. We will be looking at activities that facilitate the participation of indigenous peoples, as we have described earlier. We also are hoping for indigenous leaders and representatives from the Americas, or at least one representative per country. They will be speaking on the ways of participating in an organization such as the OAS. We will also have a representative of the Indigenous Fund for Latin America and the Caribbean from ILSA. And through you, Chairman, we should like to request the designation of a representative from the UN's Permanent Forum at the seminars and thus explain the ways in which there can be participation in this organization. After that event, there will be a final document that we hope to share with you next year. We have a program of action. The Department of International Law has a program of action on indigenous peoples aimed at strengthening the participation of indigenous peoples in the different internal and domestic and international processes. We wish to raise awareness of society and train members of indigenous peoples in different areas that will allow for comprehensive development of their communities, making the indigenous matter a cross-cutting issue through many OAS projects. The program will be inviting indigenous individuals to participate so that there can be an effect on the grassroots level and create seeds for propagating this knowledge. Thanks to the funding from the government of Germany, we have been able to hold the following events. Training activities. We have seen two events held for training in good governance and the Inter-American system. A course will be held in Panama in November of 2009. Recently, there was a seminar on the rights of indigenous peoples in the Inter-American system, the promotion and protection of indigenous and of human rights. This was held in 2009 in Bogota. We are seeking to make the indigenous perspective cross-cutting in the programs and activities of the OAS. Thus, we seek to develop a practical guide for these General from the Secretariat's staff members. We would ask if the Permanent Forum has experience in just this. There are programs of actions that have still not found funding, and we wish to propose the drafting of legal assistance programs for indigenous peoples deprived of liberty and indigenous peoples that are IDPs or immigrants. We should like to, lastly, invite the indigenous leaders of the Americas to the forum, those who have not been able to be in touch with the OAS, please come to me, and I can help you with our websites, dil@oas.org. I thank you for the time, Mr. Chairman.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much, Mr. Toro, for that information as regards the process underway with the American Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Thank you for the invitation to the seminar in June on Indigenous participation. Our forum will be sending a representative.
Muchas gracias por la invitación.
Thank you once again for that invitation. We should also like to say that the permanent forum, and in particular the secretariat, is working on training efforts of indigenous leaders and also with civil servants and officials from different UN members, government officials. It will be very important for you and the secretariat to have a time for a more thorough exchange on this matter. Thank you, Mr. Toro. A recommendation has come from the secretariat for the purposes of interpretation. Perhaps presentations can be less swift. More slowly, please. We will continue with our speakers list now. Our next speaker is Ms. Monica Aleman from the International Forum of Indigenous Women. Ms. Aleman, you have the floor.
Señora Aleman, está.
Ms. Aleman, are you in the room with us?
Entonces,
in that case, we will give the floor to Ms. Ellen Gabriel of the Indigenous Women of Quebec. Ms. Gabriel, you have the floor.
Tiene la palabra, señora.
Madam, you have the floor.
Greetings, my relations. Gender equality is virtually non-existent for Indigenous women in Canada due to the paternalistic nature of its antiquated Indian Act. Canada's refusal to embark on a genuine post-colonial process hinders women's full and effective participation in decision-making processes that seriously affect their rights, as outlined in Articles 18 and 19 of the UN Declaration. Human rights instruments in Canada do not provide sufficient protection from systemic discrimination, causing Indigenous women to be one of the most vulnerable groups in Canadian society. The double discrimination experienced by Indigenous women in Canada seriously impedes the rights affirmed by the United Nations Declarations on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples to freely determine their political status and freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development. On March 11, 2010, motivated by a court order from the Court of Appeal for British Columbia, the Government of Canada introduced Bill C-3, an act to promote gender equity in Indian registration in an attempt to end gender discrimination found within the Indian Status Registration Regime, Section 6 of the Indian Act. However, Bill C-3 will not end gender discrimination. Bill C-3 does not recognize the fundamental rights of Indigenous peoples and nations as supported in international human rights law to defend their own nationality, identity, and citizenship. The promotion of gender equality is vital to the self-determination of Indigenous peoples. Indigenous languages, culture, customary laws have been devastated by imperialism, colonization, papal bulls decreeing the doctrine of discovery, and the residential school system. Canada continues to impose a dominant culture's language and values while Indigenous peoples struggle for survival. On-reserve schools lag far behind Canada's education system. As evidenced in the Auditor General 2009 report, it will take 28 years for Indigenous community schools to be at an adequate level. And although Canada officially apologized for the residential school system, and in spite of the creation of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, there are no significant signs of reconciliation. The damage has been done, and it will take decades for the languages, educational institutions, and culture of indigenous peoples to recover from the devastating impacts of the Indian Act and the residential school. Systemic discrimination leads to the feminization of poverty and exacerbates indigenous women's marginalization as the poorest sector of the population in Canada. According to recent studies, it will take 63 years for indigenous peoples to attain the same level of income as the rest of the population. The Government of Canada must recognize the role of indigenous women in the development and well-being of indigenous communities. And while we acknowledge that Canada is considering endorsing the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous People, we recommend that the UN Permanent Forum call upon Canada to fully endorse and implement the UN DRIP in an unqualified manner, as it is the first international instrument to address the issue of double discrimination. To begin effective consultations in good faith with Indigenous peoples on how they intend to implement the UN DRIP. To implement Article 3 of the UN DRIP, recognizing the inherent right of Indigenous peoples to define their own political status, to freely pursue their economic, social, and cultural development, allowing Indigenous peoples to move positively forward towards self-determination. To implement Article 32 on lands and resources, thereby harmonizing their current land claims process, which is biased and requires the ceding of Indigenous rights to lands and its resources to comply with the minimum standards conveyed in the UN DRIP. To eradicate all forms of gender discrimination in its administrative and legislative policies. To eliminate all assimilation policies that further exacerbate the economic disparities between Indigenous peoples and the rest of the population.
Terminar su intervención.
And to adequate.
I ask you that you conclude your remarks.
Education systems and their efforts to protect and perpetuate Indigenous languages equivalent to the two official languages of Canada. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We now give the floor to our colleague, Bartolome Clavero. Sir, you have the floor. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to note the participation and presence of the Organization of American States here today. It is important that the regional organizations where there are Indigenous peoples participate in the Permanent Forum and contribute to the Permanent Forum sessions. We have been within the forum discussing an interest in the African Union also participating. In particular, we should like to encourage the African Commission on the Rights of Peoples to participate as we are looking at the International Day for the Recognition of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. The Inter-American system, the Inter-American human rights system, is developing this body of law on the regional level according to the Inter-American Court of Human Rights. The consultation process is not necessarily linked to the relevant ILO convention, but rather all American states, having ratified or not that ILO convention, must respect the right to indigenous territory and not access the resources unless it is through a process of consultation. There's the hope that this regime will be strengthened with the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples as regards the inclusion of the free, prior, and informed consent. Moving to more specific points and seeking to be brief, I should like to know to what point the change of position on the rights of Indigenous peoples in the Americas, first of Colombia and then also the announcement of a change of position on this declaration from Canada and the United States, is allowing for or not movement in this never-ending process of negotiating this declaration in the U.S. Some states have sought to use this opportunity to lower the standard of the UN declaration on this matter. If there's an effort to drop this hierarchy, has this perhaps been successfully dealt with, and have we accepted that the minimal standard for indigenous people in the Americas is that set forth by the United Nations Declaration? In the report from the OAS, perhaps because of lacking time, I did not see enough of a reference to the Inter-American Human Rights System. Both the Inter-American Human Rights Court and the Commission over the last 10 years have made a great deal of progress in receiving and recognizing and implementing the rights of the indigenous peoples in different states of the Americas, whether they recognize or not the jurisdiction of the court. But the Commission is very active. In this session of the forum, we have very much appreciated the report from the Commission on Bolivia. We are mutually reinforcing this, our work held for the permanent forum to send a mission on forced labor and captive populations in the Chaco. We very much recommend that such matters be borne in mind by the Bolivian government and all concerned parties when it comes to these dastardly and abominable practices of forced labor and servitude. Lastly, I wish to indicate that cooperation between the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights and the Permanent Forum and the seminars that are being jointly held are underway. There are final touches being part on a report on the practices of consultation among different states of the Americas. The last seminar that was held a little bit more than 1 year ago in Washington was an event that I could attend. The special rapporteur, James Anaya, was also present, and I think it is healthy that we continue with these practices of cooperation. Thank you. That would be all.
Gracias, host.
Thank you for la cooperación, underscoring the matter of cooperation with the OAS and the need to have the presence of similar organizations from Africa and other continents where there are also indigenous peoples. We will now give the floor to our colleague, Tony Agoneya. Madam Agoneya, you have the floor.
Much, Mr. Chairman, and I'd like to thank all of the participants today for their excellent contribution to the dialogue and discussion we've been having. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a comment on climate change, if I may, and this has to do with the recent World People's Conference on Climate Change and the Rights of Mother Earth that just was held in Bolivia about a week ago. As you know, there were over 35,000 people in attendance, and the majority of the attendees, a large majority, were indigenous peoples. On the matters of the rights of Mother Earth, the People's Accord that came out of that gathering rejected the carbon market and carbon offset initiatives such as RED and RED Plus that have become more profit-making enterprises, really commodifying Mother Earth and privatizing forests and not a true alternative towards combating climate change. And I wanted to bring that to the attention of the attendees here. Since the conference was going on the same time as the permanent forum. In light of the recent financial crisis, which was explained so brilliantly yesterday by our colleague Victoria, that recent financial crisis has demonstrated that the market is really not very capable of regulating the financial systems. Therefore, I think it would be irresponsible to leave the care and protection of the very existence of humanity and Mother Earth in the hands of the financial markets. That's all I have to say. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. We will continue with our speakers list. We will now give the floor to Mr. Carlos Samara, the Vice Minister of Indigenous Matters of Venezuela. Mr. Samara, you have the floor. Good morning. On behalf of the government of Venezuela, I wish to send our greetings to the entire Permanent Forum, the forum leadership, and all indigenous peoples throughout the world, government delegates. I would like to address the topic that we have today, but other matters that have been discussed also, having to do with the participation of indigenous peoples within their survival, within the framework of constitutions, and within the matter of survival in their own areas. And this is in Venezuela, and also as we look at the new independence of indigenous peoples in our country. During 2009-2010, the participation of indigenous peoples in the processes of inclusion being driven forth by the revolutionary government of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, led by President Hugo Rafael Chavez Frias, in matters of a social, political, and economic nature, the idea is to activate popular people's power in decision-making in the destiny of the country, to also find ways to ensure the happiness of the Venezuelan people, a country in which the voice of the humble are borne in mind. And this is the essence of the development of our societies. It is important to underscore that progress in indigenous matters is in the hands of the indigenous people. We must deepen the system of collective coexistence of the indigenous people as a central component of 21st century socialism. The indigenous peoples are granted the power to write their own story, and this is the story of Venezuela. This is something we see in the revolutionary government's proposals to protect the environment and the human beings. The revolutionary government seeks and activates mechanisms for the implementation of that which is demanded by the peoples. Dear brothers, with the proposal of decolonizing education, and with the issue of discovery and the conquest of our lands, we have always borne these matters in mind. We propose decolonization of education and the concepts and definitions of the capitalist world. We wish to revitalize the good living of communities, which we see in the Indian communities, indigenous communities, and indigenous African communities. We are rebuilding that destroyed by the capitalist worlds and the transnational companies that have brought tragedy to many indigenous peoples. The value of many indigenous peoples living up to one's word, the wisdom of our ancestors, these are concepts that are currently seen in indigenous communities in Latin America and the world, and we wish to deepen this in Venezuela and Bolivia and Ecuador and other countries that are part of our associations. We wish to focus on allegedly developed countries that have had a role in the loss of a humanist sense of human beings, the proposals from the indigenous movements around the world should be heard and taken into account as alternatives for saving the world, because we know that there are many cooperating and justifying the disasters that they create. And we need to focus on the cooperation to protect biodiversity, our Amazon region, our environment. We must put an end to the financial and capitalist colonialism around the world. And what have we done? In Venezuela, we are looking for the highest degree of happiness for our people through policies that are built by the people, giving powers to the actors of society, the people itself. We wish to facilitate the tools that are necessary for consolidating rights that have been denied for many years. We wish to revitalize the educational systems, medical systems, and organizational and political social structures of the indigenous peoples. Venezuela, the land of White Kipuro, and of our liberators, our beloved land. The people make up the government. The government is for the people. All leaders should hear the voice of our peoples, and we should build together the true coexistence or positive community living. Enough of things being imposed, enough of in compliance with international agreements by the powerful. Let us build a world with no differences. Let us leave behind intimidation. We want to be free. People of the world, let us defend the sovereignty of our peoples.
Gracias, señor.
Thank you, Mr. Vice Minister. Our next speaker on the list is Mr. Umaru Hindu from the Indigenous Peoples of Africa and Coordination. Mr. Hindu, you have the floor.
Merci, Monsieur le Président.
Thank you, Chairman, for having given us the floor. I wanted to remind you that since last Thursday, the African Indigenous organizations have several times asked for the floor on these different topics. Unfortunately, we have not had that opportunity up to now, and we are sorry that once again we try to get our names on the speakers list. But since we have several declarations to make, you have only given us the floor this one time, and I will now give the floor over to Saudetta to make that statement that we believe to be the most important one for us. Thank you.
Thank you. 28 indigenous leaders from Africa, from 15 countries from Africa, gathered in Bamako, Mali, to develop a strategy and action plan for the implementation of the United Nations Declaration on the Human Rights. The workshop was organized by Indigenous People of Africa Coordinating Committee, IPAC, and hosted by Tinhinan Nomadic Women Association. It was opened by the representative of the Malian Minister of Justice and closed by the High Council of Territories, Communities of the Republic of Mali. The Malian state representative welcome, delegate, and emphasize the importance of reinforcement human rights institutions and practice on African continent with particular attention to redressing the marginalization of indigenous people. The meeting had two major focused items: exploring the relationship between the United Nations Declaration on Human Rights, UNDRIP, and the African Charter on Human Rights and People, and secondly, studying issues of the human rights both at the African and international level. Principal guideline. The delegate made following observation on this meeting. The rights of indigenous peoples in Africa will only be effectively protected through the reinforcement of independent expert human rights body. Excuse me. Human rights body. Yeah, the right of indigenous people in Africa will only be effectively protected through the reinforcement of independent expert human rights body at national level, a free and responsible media, and dynamic, independent, and well-organized civil society able to monitor and work with African government on achieving human rights legislation, institution practice, and effective monitoring. Human rights are closely tied to effective democracy, good governance, and system of check and balance nationally and through the African Region Treaty System and the United Nations. Indigenous people must be given stewardship over their natural resources and the right to be involved in decision-making regarding the management of their natural resources, ecosystem, and territories. IPAC members believe that the elimination of discrimination against women has stand as a core value within indigenous organizations and communities in Africa. IPAC recognizes the African Commission on Human Rights and Peoples as the most important instrument in Africa for ensuring implementation of human rights declaration on indigenous people in the framework of African Charter. Indigenous people rights do not stand alone. The African Commission on Human Rights and People Rights remains most important instrument in Africa for ensuring implementation of the Human Rights Declaration in the framework of the African Charter. IPAC has made the following commitment at the Bamako Conference. The promotion of the UN Declaration on Rights of Indigenous People at local level with indigenous people, with a national government, with National Human Rights Commission, with traditional leaders, with African Commission on Human Rights People and its expert working group and other actors in the development issues in our countries. IPAC will work closely with the African Commission to submit shadow report on human rights, promote mission to African community, and to lobby for the creation of the post of a special rapporteur on human rights of indigenous people in Africa. They will work with its members to train indigenous leaders, civil society, NGO, human rights defenders, lawyers, and human rights officials in the legal and conceptual aspect of the Human Rights Declaration on Indigenous People and the level article of African Charter on Human Rights and People Rights. IPAC commit to inform and build capacity of indigenous leaders and communities about the international standard with regard to women's rights and elimination of gender-based discrimination of rights violation. IPAC affirmed that if indigenous people are to benefit from international and regional standard and norm, then this must be made equality accessibility to indigenous women. The Bamako Conference noted that culture and tradition are dynamic. Valuable tradition need to be safeguarded with harmful tradition, including female genital mutilation need to be stopped or transformed by the community in compliance with the law. And recommendation. Okay, I come to recommendation. Delegate emphasized that the decision in 2003 by the African Commission on Human Rights People to, to recognize indigenous people has been a major step forward, but most governments don't have a plan for implementing UN declaration, even though they voted in favor. Progress has been made only in 4 countries in Africa. Indigenous people are looking for new strategy to promote human rights and fundamental freedom in Africa. All sub-region and national delegates emphasize the importance of training and capacity building, like building alliance in the civil society, notably also including local leaders, traditional authorities, women organizations, develop advocacy capacity for national lobbying and action, link indigenous rights to the theme of good governance and democracy in the countries. Before I end my intervention, I want to share with you that in the Sahel country, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, pastoralists are affected by consequences of climate change and are facing serious food security crisis. I will speak in French. Nous appelons les.
We appeal the concerned states, the United Nations agencies, to find urgent and sustainable solutions to assist indigenous peoples, as is stated in the Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, as well as other measures taken by the United Nations. We request the American Canadian authorities to be more flexible in helping us obtain visas in order to help us to participate in the sessions of permanent bodies and other agencies within the framework of our mandate, because currently it is we have many participants who were not able to attend due to visa problems. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Ms. Saudata. We will continue with our speakers list. The next speaker on our list is Tau Nino from the Permanent Mission of China. You have the floor.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, please allow me on behalf of the Chinese delegation to express my congratulations on your election to the chairmanship of this forum. At the same time, I'd also like to express my thanks to the chair of the last session, Ms. Katara Korpus, for her outstanding work. My delegation would like to work with the experts of the forum and delegations to move the session forward toward positive results. Mr. Chairman, the Chinese delegation commends the experts for the efforts made in drafting the report on indigenous peoples and boarding schools. What needs to be pointed out is that the contents and viewpoints viewpoints expressed in the report on indigenous peoples and boarding schools are antiquated. They are at variance with the facts and also have not correctly reflected the accomplishments attained since the establishment of New China in the national minorities educational system, and particularly since the open door and reform. At an earlier stage, China had already sent a letter to the Forum Secretariat to clearly express our concerns, so I will not repeat them here. Mr. Chairman, the Chinese government attaches great importance to the educational system in the national minority regions and in the ethnic minorities, with national minorities in general. After the establishment of the new China, especially since the policy of opening to the world and reform, the educational system in the minority regions have achieved great strides in its development in an unprecedented way. Elementary education has been strengthened continuously. Vocational and adult education and higher education have moved forward comprehensively. The fifth national census indicated that in terms of the 14 minority groups, including Koreans, Manchus, Mongolians, and Kazakhs, the number of cumulative years of education they received was higher than the national average. At this time, 55 ethnic minorities have their own university students, and about 10 ethnic minorities, including Uyghurs, Wais, Koreans, and Nashis, for every 10,000 of the population, they have students attending university, and the level has become higher than the national average. In order to resolve the difficulties in attending school for students in national minority, nomadic regions, remote mountain regions, and border regions, the state has started boarding schools for ethnic minority primary schools in a number of provinces and regions. High-quality teachers have been provided, and qualifications have been strengthened. At this time, China has some 6,000 ethnic minority boarding primary schools. These schools have really had an important role in increasingly the enrollment rate and the retention rate of these primary and middle schools, and they have also used a limited amount of faculty to raise the level of these schools. This has become a very important approach to education for national minorities with Chinese characteristics. The Chinese government continue to persist in looking at the realities of these regions to increase our assistance and also further perfect our policies and measures for nurturing the talents of these regions and also supporting their development and to promote this cause in a coordinated fashion. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias a usted, señor.
Thank you, sir. We will now give the floor to our colleague, Ms. Victoria Tali Corpus. Ms. Tali, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. I would like to take the floor this time to just clarify some of the earlier statements made by my distinguished colleague, Tonya Gunilla Freshner. With due respect to Tonya, I would just like to clarify that, first of all, the statement that you are referring to, which was made in Cochabamba, is a statement that was not approved by the whole Cochabamba Conference. It's a statement that was released by the Working Group on Forests, which is a working group mainly composed of NGOs working in forests and a few indigenous organizations. The Indigenous People's Declaration, which came out from the Indigenous Working Group 7, clearly didn't mention anything about rejecting RED or RED Plus. I'd just like to clarify that because the status of statements that are being presented here, which make it appear as if this is the whole statement that came from the conference, is, I think, a misrepresentation of what has taken place in Cochabamba. The second point I'd like to raise is that the Indigenous People's Caucus, who were attending all the negotiations of the Framework Convention on Climate Change, have been discussing for many, many years all these issues related to climate change and forests. And in the final statement of the Indigenous Peoples in Copenhagen, which is the International Indigenous Peoples Forum on Climate Change, the Indigenous Peoples clearly said that there was no statement to that effect. In fact, there was a discussion among all the regional caucuses to look at this issue, and there was no consensus reached because most of the caucuses, regional caucuses, did not agree to that. And this brings me to my second to the last point, that I think when we make these kinds of statements, first of all, we have to remember that TRED, reduced emissions from deforestation and degradation, is an issue that is very much directly concerned to indigenous peoples in tropical rainforests in developing countries. And indigenous peoples in tropical rainforests have to make the decisions on how they will deal with the issue of RED. And this has been discussed in the permanent forum session 2 years ago. And we all agreed that the right to self-determination of indigenous peoples should be respected unconditionally, and they are the ones who have to make the decisions in relation to how to look at this whole RED issue and how to engage with it. I just want to make the clarification because tomorrow we are going to have a half-day session on forest, and I hope that kind of misrepresentation doesn't come into the floor again, because we have to be clear. When you say it's made in Cochabamba, you have to clarify that it's the working group on forest, of which only a few indigenous peoples were there. The indigenous people statement clearly didn't mention anything along those lines. So thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Gracias, señora Taulicor.
Thank you, Ms. Taulicorpus. Tomorrow, certainly, in the agenda, when we look at the matter of forests, we will hear the conclusions from Cochabamba, and we will know what the conclusions have been of the different working groups. We now give the floor to the representative of the Holy See, Mr. Curia Jose. You have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for giving my delegation the floor. My delegation takes this opportunity to reply to some of the comments and concerns made this morning. Regarding the question of the doctrine of discovery and the role of the papal bull Inder Chetra, the Holy See notes that Inder Chetra, as a source of international law, the division of lands between Castile, Aragon, Spain, and Portugal was first of all abrogated by the Treaty of Tordesillas in 1494, and that circumstances have changed so much that to attribute any juridical value to such a document seems completely out of place. Similarly, as a source of canon or church law, since the document has called for excommunication late sententiae, those who do not respect its dispositions in the Chetra has also been abrogated by the facts, first and foremost by the unsanctioned immediate expansion of the territory of Brazil to the west, well beyond the Treaty of Tordesillas, and by the colonization of North America and the Caribbean by the King of France. In addition, it was also abrogated by other papal bulls, for example, Sublimis Deus in 1537, which states Indians and all other people who may later be discovered by Christians are by no means to be deprived of their liberty and the possession of their property, even though they may be outside the faith of Jesus Christ, and that they may and should freely and legitimately enjoy their liberty and the possession of their property, nor should they be in any way enslaved. Should the contrary happen, it shall be null and have no effect. This view was expanded upon and reinforced in Immensa Pastorum of Benedict XVI of 20 December 17, sorry, of Benedict XIV of 20 December 1741, and a number of other papal encyclicals, statements, and decrees. If any doubt remains, it is abrogated by Canon 6 of Code of Canon Law of 1983, which abrogates in general all preceding penal and disciplinary laws. As you may gather from the above, this abrogation process took place over the centuries according to the legal maxim, lex posterior derogat priori. That is, a subsequent law imports the abolition of a previous one. Therefore, for international law and for the Catholic Church law, the bull Inter Cetera is a historic remnant with no juridical, moral, and doctrinal value. Further, the doctrine of the temporal power of the papacy, upon which Inter Cetera rests, was finally overturned by the Second Vatican Council. Finally, Mr. Chairman, the doctrine of forced conversion of non-Christians was contested and changed by the Junta Theologica de Valladolid not long after the bull of Alexander VI and was also condemned by the Second Vatican Council. Further, the assertion that wars of conquest are justifiable in order to convert non-Christians was completely overturned by the documents of the Second Vatican and by the general condemnations of war. The fact that juridical systems may employ the doctrine of discovery as a juridical precedent is therefore now a characteristic of the laws of those states and is independent of the fact that for the Church the document has had no value whatsoever for centuries. The refutation of this doctrine is therefore now under the competence of national authorities, legislators, lawyers, and legal historians. Mr. Chairman, regarding the concerns and comments raised this against the educational programs of the Church and its boarding schools in different parts of the world, my delegation would like to clarify that the ultimate objective of the Church was to offer the indigenous population improved education. Most of the leaders of such communities were formed in such education centers and are grateful for the services that received from the Church. Education is the key to development, especially when different models of development are being imposed and experimented on the indigenous communities without respect for the indigenous culture and identity. The Holy See recognizes the right of indigenous peoples for education, for development, and their traditional beliefs. For the shortcomings and mistakes, the Church has sought always means of dialogue and reconciliation. Last year, for example, when Pope Benedict XVI received the representatives of the First Nation in Canada, this issue was discussed. In addition, in a number of meetings and discussions with indigenous peoples from around the world, Pope John Paul II also reiterated the Holy See's support for the rights of the indigenous peoples while acknowledging and asking forgiveness for past mistakes by missionaries. With this explanation, Mr. Chair, I hope the following becomes clear. The Holy See confirms that Inter Cetera has already been abrogated and considers it without any legal or doctrinal value. Two, the Holy See, in accordance with Catholic social teaching, is consistently paying particular attention to the relationship of indigenous peoples to their lands and resources. Three, the Holy See has demonstrated also by our support for the recent declaration of the rights of the indigenous peoples, and it will continue to be an outspoken moral voice in support of the dignity and rights of all indigenous peoples. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Señor, muchas gracias por.
Thank you for your words, sir. We have received numerous recommendations in the permanent forum in addressing these matters. I invite you and the Holy See to be part of these working groups in order to discuss these matters at depth. For us, it is important This has greatly marked our lives for centuries. I merely wish to personally remind you that when the Spaniards arrived in Peru, they arrived with the images of St. James, and in our countries, he is known as St. James the Indian Killer, and that is what is stuck in our imagery. Ms. Fritschner has the floor. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to make a very short statement and to thank the distinguished representative from the Observer, Holy See, for his kind remarks. And I would like to direct our delegates attending here at the Permanent Forum's ninth session that many of the points that the Holy See representative brought to our attention have been addressed in the preliminary study. And I would bring to their attention that the document that they should be addressing is E/C.19/2010/13. And I would direct their attention to paragraph 15 and to paragraph 17. I understand, and we have had meetings with the representatives of the Holy See, and that we have been advised that the Sublimitas Deus of 1537 had been abrogated. However, I would point out that this particular approach towards indigenous peoples, this doctrine of discovery, has been institutionalized in law and policy. This system of violence has been put in place. And the doctrine of discovery may not have value for the Holy See for centuries. But, however, I would kindly and respectfully bring to the attention of the Holy See, this is something that has been brought to our attention as indigenous peoples most recently. And since it has been recently realized, it is something that we are going to approach with due diligence, because that is our responsibility to our ancestors, to our people now, and to the seventh generation that hasn't arrived yet. So I would thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for your time.
Señor Bartolomé.
Mr. Clavero. You could have the floor, but perhaps briefly, because we are very short on time. Yes, I wish to also thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to refer to the remarks from the representative of the Holy See. I am a historian, a legal historian, and the explanations that we have heard of the overturning of the bulls that allowed for the invasion of the Americas by Spain and Portugal are not supported by canonic law, in which the principle of ex posteriori derogat priori has a very limited effect. The Church believes that aside from positive law, there is a natural law, and above that, a divine law. And these bulls were manifestations of what the Church believed to be of divine right. And those bulls have not been overturned. The code of canonic law has had a very limited effect of overturning some things, but nothing that the Church believes to fall within the scope of natural or divine law. So I appreciate what he has said, in as much as the Catholic Church wishes to look at the rights that allowed for the invasion of America as no longer valid. But the current impact is a fact. And the current bishop in Rome and current head of state of the Holy See hold positions that are absolutely traditional, in step with traditional positions, and what they refer to as the evangelization of the Americas was still defendable. When the representative of the Holy See referred to the right of education, the right to development, it would seem that these are that this fails to see the the rights to self-determination of the indigenous peoples, which has not been recognized by the Church. Although John Paul II was more sensitive to these than the current Holy See leadership. Lastly, I see more problems than responses in the remarks from the representative of the Holy See. Thank you.
Gracias, señor Clavero.
Thank you, Mr. Clavero. We have reached the end of our 11th session in accordance with our program of work. We will have a half-day session on indigenous peoples and the mosques. The reference document is
Bosques.
The matter will be forests. Tomorrow, and the Secretariat has an important announcement to make.
Thank you, sir. I have just one announcement to make. The Indigenous Caucus will meet at 3 o'clock in the afternoon in room E on the second floor of this building, and the room only holds about 60 to 80 people. Please keep that in mind. There will be interpretation provided for this event. And also, our esteemed chairman asked me to thank our interpreters for giving us a few extra minutes for this meeting. Thank you very much.
Levanta la sesión.
The meeting is adjourned.
Muchas gracias por...